John chapter 11, and we're going to probably wrap up John chapter 11 here. We're dealing with this final sign that Jesus performs in his personal ministry, and that is, of course, the resurrection of Lazarus. And so John chapter 11, and down again at verse 39, Jesus said, "Take away the stone." And Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" And so we left off talking about that a little bit and having some discussion about that, and good discussion. And you come to your own conclusion about we did point out that Jesus is angry at this time, and that is indicated when it says that he was troubled, spirit was moved, and the Greek word there leave no doubt, but that he was upset, indignant, agitated, the Greek words mean. And so he was upset with that, and the various, even in our discussion, various views of what made him mad. So my conclusion was it was just sin. It was just Satan and sin, more so than a lack of faith on the part of Mary and Martha. Some believe it was a lack of faith on their part. Some believe it was the hypocrisy of the mourning Jews. But one thing I would point out, and then we'll just move on from that quickly, is the one thing that might modify my position would be what he says here in this verse 40. "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" Now, I'm not quite sure what that's referring to be honest with you. If that could be just him restating what he said in verse 23 and verse 25. Verse 23, you remember he said, Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." And then at verse 25, after she said, "I know, I'll see him again in the resurrection of the last day," then he said, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live." And he could have meant that by those statements that he indicated to her that she would see the glory of God. If that is the case, then again, my position is they didn't really demonstrate that much of a lack of faith by not concluding that he was going to raise their brother from the dead just by those statements. Because those statements are kind of vague, to tell you the truth. You could take those statements. In fact, if he was speaking to me and I heard him say these things, I would not think that he was about to raise my loved one from the dead on the spot, particularly with my core belief that there's going to be a resurrection someday, which was her core belief. So, you know, you say, "I'm the resurrection, I'm alive. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live." Well, I believe that. I think about Whitney. I'll see her again in the resurrection someday. And if Jesus was standing right here and talking to me about her, I wouldn't take that and think, "Oh, he's about to take me to her gravesite and raise her up." I would think just what Martha did. "I'll see her again in the resurrection in the last day." Now, what might modify all of that is this. It could be when he said this, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God?" He could be referring there to something that we don't have. In other words, I've said to you many times, we don't ever have full conversations from all of these people. And certainly we don't have the full conversation between Jesus and Martha. And if Jesus said this, what he said in verse 40, if that's not just a restatement of verses 23 and 25, and he actually told her about seeing the glory of God here, then that might change things a little bit. But we really don't have record of him saying that to her. Like, he said that to the disciples. You remember down at verse 4 when he first heard of the illness of Lazarus. He said, "This illness doesn't lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." But they weren't around when he said that. He was saying that to his disciples. And so if he said that to them, which we don't have any record of, then that might change that situation just a little bit. But my conclusion in the overall thing is, I'm just saying, one way or the way, however you take it, I don't know that we should come down too hard on Mary and Martha, is really my whole point in this. They demonstrate through the narratives that talk about their lives a great deal of loyalty and faith in Jesus Christ. And as I said, I think Martha especially, when she says, even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give it to you. We know she wasn't talking about an immediate resurrection because of what follows. She's demonstrating great faith in, even though he disappointed her. Even though he didn't show up on time, her faith didn't waver. And I'm personally impressed by that and appreciate that. All right, let's move on from that. Verse 41 says, and so they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. And so he goes to his father in prayer, and he does it for a specific reason. And he is showing the great relationship that he has with his father, and that he, of course, figuratively has the ear of his father. And that's the relationship that they have. And so this miracle that he's about to perform, it's a joint effort. He's given his father glory, that it is through him, God working through Jesus, that Lazarus would be raised from the dead. One thing we learned as an aside here, is there anything wrong with public prayer? No. No, I know Jesus once said that we pray in the closet, but that he was dealing with a specific thing there. There's nothing wrong with public prayer. And here Jesus is praying publicly, specifically, so people around him could hear. And that would result in some faith on their part and understanding of his relationship with the Father. So he prays for this. And then it says, and when he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the man who had died came out, his hands and his feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, unbind him, let him go. Now, this was a powerful sign, a powerful miracle. And I would argue that everybody in the vicinity, everybody there who saw this or heard about it, should have believed immediately that Jesus is the Christ. You imagine something like this happening today. And I've often talked, if you weren't here on Sunday nights, aren't here on Sunday nights, we've talked a little bit about miracles, but all really from the standpoint of how they're transferred and that sort of thing. But, I mean, if miracles like this were happening today, there would be, people would know that a real, genuine miracle took place. Like, I would believe, if somebody was raised, and it could really be verified. Let's say someone died in our day and time, 21st century. They died in the hospital. That can be verified, can't it? Now, you're going to have, you could talk to the doctor. He died on my operating table. He's dead. He died. You have medical records, hospital records. Say they took him to the grave site and the funeral home. You have a record, you have a paper trail of all of that. You know this person is dead. The place where he's buried has been purchased and all of that. There's no doubt about it. Might have a death certificate, whatever. I mean, there's no doubt. Now, you raise someone like that. You take me to a gravesite and raise someone like that from the dead. And I tell you, I'll never, ever preach again that miracles have ceased. In fact, I'll make it my mission to convince everybody there's still miracles if that happened. But is that happening today? They have these crusades and people die or supposedly die and 2 minutes later the eyes open back up, a resurrection. Or they tell stories about someone way off somewhere who we heard this person was raised from the dead. None of it is verifiable. It's all deniable. But you really raise someone from the dead, like I just explained a moment ago. And you show me the records. I want to know I want to know his family, the people, the fellow who tried to revive him or whatever, who worked. I want to hear from the doctor. Prove to me that this person really died, was really placed in a grave, and was really raised from the dead. You have something. But that would be on CNN, that would be on Fox News, Good Morning, every social media outlet, that would be everywhere quick. But you never see any of that. Because all the ones who are claiming, like Benny Hinn and the rest of them, claiming that they have raised someone from the dead, he's made that claim two or three times. If he really did that, there would be some evidence. And if it was real, people would pick up on that. If it could really be proven, people would pick up on that. Now, I said all of that to say this. That's the kind of miracle that we just read about. Of course, it was back in those days in the first century. But if that happened in the 21st century, of all the evidence and proof that they had back then, it'd be just like having looking at the death certificate. I mean, people knew Lazarus, knew Mary and Martha. They probably were a somewhat affluent family. Most scholars believe, and there's different reasons why they come to that conclusion. One was the grave that he was in. Like, they had different kinds of graves and sepulchres at that time. And some that were for the more wealthy. First of all, if you were really rich, they had below level, ground level sepulchres. You had to walk down a flight of steps to get to the body there. But then even like the one he was in, that you had to hew out of a cave, was really not for the poor. So I don't know that this family was well. In the next chapter, we'll see somehow Mary has a whole lot of expensive perfume. And all the evidence leans to this is a family that was, you know, at the very least we could say they were middle class. And maybe a little bit more than that. I didn't bring it out though, but when, you know, we've talked about those people that came and mourned with Mary and Martha. That was a typical thing to do, but generally it was people from your own town or village. The indication here was that people came from other places. And that would only happen with a family that was pretty well known. And so the point of it all is this. People knew who Lazarus was. And they knew that he died. And he was placed in a tomb. And when he came out again, Jesus called him by name. He was there for a specific reason to raise a specific person. There was no fakery. Nobody could claim, he was just tricked. And he just kind of snuck in there and stuck out. No, they had to roll the stone away to get him out. And when he came out, he still had his grave clothes on. And he was wrapped up. He said, unbind him and let him go. He couldn't do that himself, could he? There's strong evidence that this was a real, genuine raising up, resurrection from the dead. No doubt about it. It'd be like us today having the death certificate, having the testimony of the doctor, knowing the hospital, talking to the family. It'd be no doubt about it. And that's why I said a moment ago, everybody there, all of these people that were around, they should all immediately bow down and say, this is the Lord. We believe in him. But that, of course, wasn't the reaction. At verse 45, it says, many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. So these were people with an honest heart. They saw this thing and, wow, I mean, this, there's no doubt. This is the long-awaited Messiah, and they believed in him. But then there were others, said, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them that what Jesus had done. Now, that doesn't really tell us whether or not they believe, but either way, it looks bad for them. Like, if they didn't believe, then you have to ask the question, what in the world would it take to get them to believe that Jesus was the Messiah if this didn't do it? Now they saw a genuine resurrection. If that didn't cause them to believe, what would, you would wonder? If they did believe, again, here they are. They obviously care more about what the Pharisees think and about their social standing and all of that than the fact that a real, genuine miracle has been performed and has proven that the Messiah is here. So, I mean, it boggles the mind that some of them had that reaction. Verse 45, we see the reaction that we would all think. They believed. But the other ones, they just went back to the Pharisees and said what Jesus had done. And then verse 47, so the chief priest and the Pharisees gathered the council together and said, what are we to do? Now, again, maybe these folks now, they didn't actually see it, but they knew Lazarus had died. Many of them, at least. The evidence is still there. And now, what are they? What kind of question is that after a real resurrection has taken place? What do you mean, what should we do? We ought to run over there and accept him as our long-awaited Messiah. That's what we ought to do. But they're not thinking about that at all. They're still thinking about their own social standing, and that comes out even later on in the next chapter. But here, the chief priest and the Pharisees gather the council together. That's the Sanhedrin there. What are we to do? For this man performs many signs. They don't even deny that. He performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away our place in our nation. I mean, where's their priorities here? They're just worried about that. You know, the Jews have it pretty good in the Roman Empire, which is somewhat puzzling in itself. That's always been a long-standing, you know, situation. People just think for years about how did the Jews ever really pull that off? I mean, the Romans didn't like them at all. And they got a lot. They got away with a whole lot that other nations didn't get away with. And yet they had pretty good standing. And they could even worship their God and all of that and do have their synagogues and everything and the temple and everything. And all, you know, all of that. They had it pretty good. And they don't want any of that messed with at all. And so now they're worried. Now, here's someone who has just raised someone from the dead. Now forget about that. We like our standing with the Romans. And if a bunch of people keep on believing, and now a bunch of people have just believed, and if he keeps this up, we know he's performing all these signs. Well, wouldn't you get to thinking right there, he's performing all these signs. Perhaps he is the Messiah. We better accept him. But they're not going down that road at all. And so it's amazing that how they behave. And we'll see that we keep reading here, and it says that if we let him go like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all." Now, let me just pause and say, now this is the Sanhedrin. You know, all they can think about is their place. You might think before you read this, well, certainly the high priest, the religious leader amongst the Jews, would have some interest in this man maybe being the Messiah. But he's not thinking about that. They can't even rely on their high priest. They have no directional help at all as a nation. And as I said, I think in an earlier lesson, this is why the Jews ended up being what they were. They had no leadership almost from the beginning. They constantly had kings that were leading them astray, prophets that were corrupt, false prophets, and so on, high priests that were corrupt. And so that doesn't justify the fact that they were stiff-necked people, as we have seen over and over. But, I mean, they were just a mess, and a lot of it was because of their leadership. So now you have the high priest, Caiaphas. He was high priest that year. He said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish." And first of all, they're overreacting about the whole situation. The nation isn't going to perish because of this situation anyway. They are going to perish, but it's going to be because of their rejection of Christ. And they're ultimately going to be destroyed as a nation anyway in AD 70, at least Jerusalem and all of that, Judaism, that sort of thing. But just think about this. Right away, he's not thinking. What is he saying here? Well, what should we do about this? He has the answer. What does he want to do? In fact, he's amazed that these scribes, these Pharisees, chief priests, they don't already know this. Don't you know nothing? What's he basically saying they have to do? You got to kill them. I want you to stop and think about that. And this goes on. We'll see a little bit later. They have the same attitude towards Lazarus. But we're talking about murder here. How would we feel about somebody, some politician or someone who came out and we got letters of this politician, some governor or whatever it is, some senator writing a letter about murdering somebody? How long would he stay in office? I mean, this is wicked. They know, first of all, they know Jesus is an innocent man, and they have already admitted he has performed many signs, and some of them have even seen this resurrection. And now they want to plot to murder him. And it's just amazing where their minds are, all because they don't want to lose their station in the Roman Empire and the situation that they're in. Now, this is kind of interesting with Caiaphas. It says he did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Probably talking about the Jews and the dispersion that live outside of Jerusalem, might encompass even, you know, the other sheep, the Gentiles ultimately. But what he was saying was prophetically true. He didn't know really what he was saying. That's not to say that his heart wasn't wicked. Or, I mean, he knew what he wanted. He wanted Jesus put to death. He just doesn't realize that what he just set forth prophetically was God's plan of salvation. Like, he's going to get what he wants ultimately. What he says right here is exactly what's going to happen. They're not going to perish immediately, but the one man is going to be put to death. But it's not because they plotted and planned and pulled it off. It's because it's God's plan of salvation. So what he was speaking here was prophetically right, but being the wicked man that he was, he had no idea about it. So from that day on, it says, they made plans to put him to death. And Jesus, therefore, no longer walked openly amongst the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness to a town called Ephraim. And there he stayed with his disciples. Now, Ephraim was about 13 miles northeast of Jerusalem, so far enough away where he wouldn't be bothered with the Sanhedrin in this particular place. We really don't know much about Ephraim, by the way. In fact, there's no biblical record of it at all. Josephus mentions the town of Ephraim when Vespasian was on the attack against, but that's the only record. There's, you know, we read about who was Ephraim? Remember? Right, the son of Joseph. And so obviously he's mentioned. And so the tribe of Ephraim is mentioned several times. And even the hill country of Ephraim. But there's no record of a village or a town called Ephraim except here. But what they think it was, the place where scholars think it was located about 13 miles northeast of Jerusalem. But the point of it is, Jesus withdrew. Did Jesus withdraw because he was afraid of them?
No.
Exactly right, Sam. It wasn't his time. It wasn't his time. And it's sort of interesting. All of this is the plan. All of this is on God's time schedule. And it's interesting that this is Jesus. Throughout his ministry, we've seen Jesus do this sort of thing. Even in the book of John, we've seen him, when people wanted to kill him, he just left, got away or whatever, and got out of where they were. And a lot of times he would perform miracles and tell the people, don't tell anybody about it. Why? Because it wasn't his time. In the very next chapter, when we get into the next chapter, we're going to be in the final week of our Lord's life on earth, which is a very exciting week. In fact, it's interesting. Where are we? This is John chapter 12, and it's his final week. So John takes almost half of the book, not quite, but almost half of the book to deal with the final week of our Lord's ministry here on earth. In other words, we've already covered over 3 years, and he's going to take the rest of the book to deal with 1 week But that starts in the next chapter. And one of the things we'll see in chapter 12 is the triumphant entrance into Jerusalem. And you know whose idea that was? That was Jesus' idea. He sends a couple of disciples off to get a donkey that he's going to ride on into Jerusalem. The whole thing is his idea. So everything's going to change in chapter 12. Now, instead of saying, don't tell anybody, and withdrawing, he's going to ride on the back of a donkey right into the heart of the Jews, back into Jerusalem. And people are going to love him. And people are going to acknowledge his messiahship. Many people, anyway. And so that's coming. But right now, here at the end of chapter 12, he withdraws himself because it wasn't his time. It had nothing to do with him being afraid. It wasn't his time. And so he withdraws himself then to this place that is called Ephraim. Let's see. Now, what verse was that? I ramble so much I forget. 54. Oh boy, I'm a mess, huh? All right, 55, that now the Passover, the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. And they were looking for Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, what do you think, that he will not come to the feast at all? Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so that they might arrest him. And that's sort of an interesting development there at the end of that, at the end of the chapter there, that they want Jesus, but they can't find him. So now they put it out to everyone. If you know where he is, tell us. And really, it's more, you better tell us. We want to know so we can arrest him. He's a criminal, and you don't want to harbor a criminal. So if you know where he is, you better let us know. And that kind of puts in the light what happens next. As we get into chapter 12, I think we have time to get into it just a little bit. But in chapter 12, we see a bunch of friends of Jesus basically throwing him a dinner party. Like they're not afraid at all of the Sanhedrin and what they're saying. They're really, it's kind of risky to do what they do in chapter 12 there. Because again, they now are plotting to arrest Jesus, to kill Jesus. They want him dead, and they want the help of the people in all of that. All right, any questions about chapter 11? Any questions about chapter 11? All right, get right into chapter 12. We only have a few minutes to get into chapter 12. But as I suggested, it says at the beginning here, six days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So he's been away here for a little bit, and in this place called Ephraim, and we don't know exactly how much time has passed, but some time. And so now he comes back because it's the Passover, and so he's going there, and so is everybody else. There's generally speaking, with the Passover, there's over a million Jews in Jerusalem whenever the Passover came around. Some believe that there were closer to 2 million based on, they have record of how many animals needed at a particular time for the sacrifices and that sort of thing. And so you multiply that out and they conclude there are probably about 2 million people in Jerusalem. Now, most think that might be a little bit of an exaggeration. But just to be conservative, there was at least a million people in Jerusalem. And over a million people in Jerusalem. And that's only amazing to me, because if I know many of you have made a trip to Israel, and you know Israel, Jerusalem is not a big place, is it? You can walk from one side to the other on a tour. And at this time, there's during the Passover time, people would start coming in before the Passover. People would start arriving, and so the point is, there's a lot of people in Jerusalem at this time, and that's where Jesus is now heading. But before he gets there, he stops at Bethany, And because that's where his good friends are, again, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus. Now, there's a lot John doesn't say. You go to the synoptic gospels, and there's all kind of things that happen between Ephraim and Bethany and by the time he gets to Jerusalem. I mean, we have things like, you remember the healing of the 10 lepers? Remember that? Well, that happens during this period of time. He heals 2 blind men. He blesses some children. Says something along the line of how we ought to be like them. All kind of things. A bunch of parables he gives between this period of time. Some sermons he's preached. So a lot goes on. John doesn't talk about any of it. Which is, that's just the nature of the Gospels. They all added some and material and left out some things that happened in the life of Jesus. But he then, we get to chapter 12, and John gets Jesus here to Bethany. And he arrived 6 days before the Passover. And so it says, Jesus therefore came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they gave a dinner for him there. And now watch this. Tell me how many of you are shocked by these next few words. Martha served. We get the idea now. We're starting to kind of be familiar with these, at least Mary and Martha, aren't we? Martha did what she always did. Now, they're not in their own house here. They're in a fellow by the name of Simon's house. Let me just stop there. The bell's going to ring. They're having this dinner party, and what a party. The Son of God is there. Would you like to be at that dinner party? And Lazarus was there, a man who was dead, but now he's alive again because of Jesus. And also, it's in the house of a man named Simon who was a leper. You think he's still a leper? Of course not. If he was, where would he be? Yeah, he wouldn't be there. He'd be in isolation. And so he has been healed. Most all believe, and I don't know how you would believe anything else, that Jesus healed him. Are you surprised that they're throwing him a party? He's raised Lazarus from the dead. He's probably healed Simon from a dreadful, horrendous kind of disease that left you isolated and away from your family. And Lazarus' sisters are there. And so they're throwing them this dinner, and it's an open thing. It's nothing that's secret or anything. Later on, we're going to find that now the Jews know about Lazarus and where he is, and they start to plot to kill him too. They don't want to kill Jesus. They want to get rid of the evidence of this great miracle that he's performed. So, but they're having this dinner, and we find here the first thing that is said is Martha served. And we've said a lot over the years about her being different than Mary, and Mary always wanted to sit at Jesus' feet and all of that, and that's true. And Martha was too busy, worried about the physical stuff, and there's some truth to that too. But what's interesting here is it doesn't say anything in this text about Martha grumbling or being upset at all. Last time we were in their house and she was serving, she was complaining. And they only had one guest. It was the greatest guest of all. But they only had one guest and she's complaining. Aren't you going to have my sister help me? Now she's serving a house full, but no complaining. Why do you think that is? You think maybe because this man who they're honoring has raised her brother from the dead might have something to do with that? And remember, she has made the confession back in the previous chapter that she believes that he is the Christ, the Son of God. Now she serves him happily, gladly. And that's exactly what we should do. When we think about all that he has done for us, we shouldn't be complaining about our service either, should we? We'll talk more about that next time we're together, along with Lazarus and Mary. Some interesting things to point out about both of them as well. Appreciate your attention.